Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Catherine Brigantino. Thanks to Daniel Angrenon for producing today's show. We've got a really great hour lined up for you today. After the break, we'll be talking with Jason Luderman, the program manager of Friends of the Sea Otter, which is a really amazing group in the United States that works to protect endangered sea otters. But first up, I'm excited to welcome Ashley Meyer, the co-founder and co-director of Connect the Dots. Connect the Dots is an organization that promotes and builds capacity to address the connections between human, animal, and environmental well-being. Connect the Dots works to highlight those links between animal, human, and environmental well-being, while also fostering a connectionist movement, a movement of individuals who reject the false dichotomies dividing our movements and are dedicated to working comprehensively toward a peaceful and just world for all. In addition to co-founding and co-directing Connect the Dots, Ashley Meyer has spent over a decade working to prevent gendered violence at the local and state levels in Missouri, California, and Oregon. She will soon be moving on to become the executive director of Last Chance for Animals in Los Angeles. Ashley holds an MSW with a focus on women's studies and is currently pursuing a Master of Public Administration and Master of Public Health degrees. Welcome to Animal Voices, Ashley.
Thank you.
So happy to have you on. I feel like a lot of the work that you're doing with Connect the Dots aligns really nicely with what we are trying to do with Animal Voices, so I'm very excited. I'm wondering if we can just start off by talking about this term connectionist. So you call yourself a connectionist, and I want to know what you mean by that and what you also mean by using the connectionist theory of change.
Yeah, you know, when I call myself a connectionist, I'm not looking to create this new term. I think that what happened was I couldn't really find a way to talk about myself and kind of my theory and how I operate and the lens through which I see the world. I mean, vegan feminist for sure is something that I would call myself, but connectionist is really a term that I started using to really point out intentionally the connections that I make, that the lens that I use to kind of go about and view the world is about the connections between human, animal, and environmental well-being. And one of the key components for that, I think, is a rejection of kind of the siloed nature of the work that we do. The feminist world, we call them false dichotomies, these divisions that are false, that don't need to be there. And for that to really make sense to me, I needed a word, one word that I could call myself. And that's really where connectionist came from. And then, so for the connectionist theory of change, I've been in a lot of public health work, which I'm sure we'll get to, specifically working to prevent gendered violence. And a theory of change is something we talk about a lot, the fact that if we're going to do work and do it effectively, we need to know kind of how it is and why it is that we think what we're doing is going to create change. And so it was just kind of natural to start thinking about, well, what's our theory of change? And it comes from a lot of different theories. One theory is called diffusion of innovation, and very, very simply put, it's this idea that, you know, you kind of spread something new out there throughout society, and people will pick it up, and it'll diffuse and create change that way until, you know, you have really, what I see is you have a movement. And so the connectionist theory of change is a very simple theory of change. It's the idea that the more people who really start making those connections in the work that they do in their daily lives, the more we're going to have a world that's peaceful and just, and the more people are going to be able to see how the work that they're doing really needs to incorporate humans, animals, and the environment, or their daily choices, you know, needs to consider the well-being of all.
Mm. So what about your story? How did you come to make those connections in your own life?
Well, again, the work that I've done a lot is the prevention of gendered violence. And so when I say that, I mean mostly for me it's sexual and domestic violence. And I found that when, you know, I was really working to do this work, I kept feeling like it wasn't enough, like it wasn't doing enough. And I think we feel like that a lot when we're doing social justice work. But I actually went vegan several years ago during the work that I was doing at a hospital-based domestic violence program. And I think it kind of clicked for me then that I realized, you know, we keep talking about these issues of power and really rejecting the notion of having power over, and that's a big component in something like domestic violence, is a sense of entitlement. And I thought, well, how are we going to change that? How are we going to change these attitudes in people, you know, these norms or standards for behavior that we have in society, if every day those same norms are being really supported through what we're doing in terms of our choices for daily living, like eating, entertainment, and things like that. And so I think it just kind of, for me, it just kind of naturally happened that I realized, hey, we need to go a step further in our analysis.
I actually came across your work with Connect the Dots through Jennifer from Because We Must, and then I found out that you were one of the writers for Because We Must, which is really awesome. So how does your work with Because We Must fit in with Connect the Dots?
Well, I think Because We Must, as you said, you know, I have been writing and working with Jennifer as well with Because We Must, and I really have a good relationship with the founder who knew what we were doing with Connect the Dots, and one day kind of, I think, sent me a Facebook message and said, hey, you know, you have to hear about my new project. It was inspired by Connect the Dots. And so I think that Because We Must really embodies what we're looking for. We talk about on our mission, you know, building capacity to do this work, to do what I call connectionist work. And Because We Must is, you know, one of the first successes in that, you know, really inspiring people to really take this and to make it the core of the work that they're doing. When they think about social justice, they're connecting the dots.
So great to hear. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to your work to prevent gendered violence, and I'm wondering if we can talk more about those connections between gendered violence and struggles for animal and earth liberation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that's really popular in the work that I'm doing is this idea of these norms. So these often kind of unspoken, but they're there, and they're standards of behavior for how we operate, they exist in society. A group called the Prevention Institute, which is very popular in the kind of human rights world, has really put out their 5 key norms that support and sustain an environment and a society in which gender violence can happen. And 2 of those norms are power and violence. And so, you know, when you think about that, obviously it's very easy to see. We can look at media representations of, you know, what advertisers put out there for what's sexy, it's violent, especially a lot of times you see men, you see white people having power over people of color. Like, it's just this really common message that we see and we might not even really digest. It's just sent to us all the time. So obviously, and I've heard a lot of people on your show actually talk about this, is that we see this also then in how we view animals, and I would say how we view the earth as well, in terms of, you know, might makes right, because we can have power and use animals and, you know, natural resources for our own comfort, then we do. And I think that just connects absolutely to gendered violence and the entitlement that you see when you're looking at, you know, why is it that people perpetrate something like sexual violence? It's because I can, because I'm entitled to it. You know, there's something about me that allows me to have power over this person. And a lot of times, you know, it's this kind of unearned social power. And I think that we can really connect that back. And when we talk about it at Connect the Dots, is kind of providing a scaffold for kind of the, you know, whatever you want to call them, social evils that most people are against. Most people will say, yeah, child abuse, oh, that's awful, rape, oh, of course, I think it's awful. But they're not connecting the dots to, well, look at how it is that we're treating non-human animals. And the exact same attitude, this, it's okay for me to have power, it's okay for me to use and exploit this being because I can, is exactly the same as what we see when we're looking at something like gendered violence. Hmm.
Are you seeing spaces to have these sorts of conversations within human rights frameworks, within human rights organizations, people that are working for specifically human-centered projects? Are you seeing spaces open up? What's your sense of the pulse on that?
Oh, I have a sense for sure. I think things have changed a lot. When I first started kind of getting this, for lack of a better term, and really having this lens and wanting to talk about it, it wasn't safe. I could lose my job. And I talk about that, and, you know, we have a collection of essays for Connect the Dots that'll be coming out, and mm-hmm. I have one, and I say, you know, it's not something that I've always really wanted to talk about because it was threatening. It is threatening still. It depends on the space. I think we've made some very slow, maybe moderate progress in that I am honestly meeting more vegans who are open about it in my work to prevent gendered violence. But not a lot. It's still something that, you know, I still get that response of, oh, animals, you know, what? Come on, humans are so much more important. Mm. And so I think just again, you know, even in the work that we're doing, it's supposed to be all about challenging power structures and really promoting social justice and equity. We're just not connecting those dots there. And so that's exactly why we exist.
So what are some of the tools that you use to speak back against that critique that, you know, we so often hear that, well, we really need to worry about humans first?
Well, I mean, I think one of the tools, honestly, is feminism. I mean, feminism talks about false dichotomies and talks about this idea of, you know, it's not either or, it's both and. And so, you know, so often in this work, we really do use a feminist lens or feminist theory in the work to prevent gendered violence. But I think that, you know, I can take it back to that and kind of point out, well, look at the central tenets of feminism. Oftentimes that works. You know, sometimes it doesn't. I think that we're so socialized to really, really see this hierarchy of worth that it's going to take some time. But there are lots of tools there, and I think that a lot of times you can point it back to the central tenets of the work that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think people are sometimes really shocked to think about the fact that, oh, my gosh, you know, I've never thought about that before, but that's core to the work that we're doing, and we just completely ignore it.
Ashley, I want to talk about this collection of essays that's in production. So let's talk about the book. What inspired it, and whose voices will be highlighted in it?
Connect the Dots is a collaboration between a colleague, Stacia Mesla, and I, started years and years ago. Mm. And one of the first things that we talked about was kind of how are we going to get this out there? And so the book idea really came up. We thought, you know, what's better than to launch an idea that maybe isn't talked about that much with a book? What we found is that the way, you know, blogs have really taken off and kind of the explosion of some of the internet sources of media has happened first beyond the book. So, you know, we've gone ahead and really developed Connect the Dots as we're developing this book. I think we always had this idea that the book would come out and then Connect the Dots would, you know, start its work, but that's just by necessity. It didn't happen that way. But it will be coming out this year, most likely in summer, and it's going to be a collection of a mixture of voices, all different folks with all different identities, talking about kind of their perspectives, talking about how it is that they see that human, animal, and environmental well-being are connected, talking about what's sometimes referred to as the commonality of oppression, the same kind of questions you've been asking me, you know, how did they get there? What advice do they have for folks who are seeing this and wanting to incorporate it into their work? And it's going to be a nice mixture of people from multiple movements with multiple voices and multiple identities.
And, I mean, it sounds like it's coming from a feminist framework as well, like telling our story, sharing our narrative, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, feminism really does, it really informs a lot of what we do. You know, I think partly because you have the founders who are, you know, feminists at heart. And so of course you're going to see that in our work.
Amazing. So you keep mentioning, you've mentioned the blog a few times. So can we talk mm-hmm. about the role of the blog in the development of Connect the Dots and how you see, I mean, do you see writing as an effective tool? Why do you do it?
Oh, absolutely. I think with writing, there's always kind of this catharsis aspect, for me at least, I would assume for a lot of other folks. So it's one of those things that I really like to do. I know Stacia really likes to do it. And we found as we were working on the book that it was around the time when blogs were just taking off. And, you know, it's really a way to get information out there quickly and start conversations. And with Connect the Dots, we really do want to, and we are, building a movement. And so that was one thing that we just saw as a necessity. It was easy to start a blog. We have lots to write about, lots of people who want to write for us. And so we just went ahead and started that blog. And it's been going for about, 4 years now. And so, you know, it's very easy to look back and see kind of a progression of, you know, some of our first posts when we're kind of starting to talk about it and putting it out there as an idea, to really breaking it down and looking at and responding to specific things that are happening, maybe that are not connecting the dots, and really highlighting what we call connectionist resources. So things like Because We Must, that are connecting the dots and promoting the work. And so it's evolving, and we just see it as a really essential way to keep the conversation going, to build a movement, and also to show people that they're not alone. That was a big piece of why Connect the Dots started, that there really was this need. Folks who were, for example, you know, working in, say, sexual and domestic violence prevention, like I was, and were vegan, for example, we're having a really hard time and feeling really alone, and not being able to find people within their own movement who understood where they were coming from, you know, who didn't have this resistance to the fact that, you know, hey, I'm also talking about, you know, rights here or earth liberation and things like that. So it's really been a way to connect folks. And I just got it. Email from a woman who said that, you know, she cried when she found us, and you know, she finally saw people were talking about something that she thought she might have been the only one talking about and feeling. And so that's really an example of, you know, why we do what we do. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you put it out there online, it's just an additional way to build community.
And you can really see that on the website. Lots of feedback on the blog posts, and, you know, you weigh in on things that are timely, and also take a step back and talk about more abstract theoretical ideas, and providing people with those tools to help navigate and make those connections, which I really appreciate. So thank you for your work on that.
No problem.
So there's a lot going on with Connect the Dots. You're also a student. You also are a worker. And I'm sure this is the case for a lot of people who are socially conscious, social justice activists, people that are involved with making positive, progressive social change. So any advice? How do you juggle all the balls in the air?
That's a really good question. And I mean, I would say that, you know, my partner in this work, Stacia Mesla, is the same. You know, she's a mother. She's got a lot going on, too. And I think for us, I can't speak for Stacia, but I, you know, we know each other very well. And I think for us, there's just this sense of urgency that at the time when we started Connect the Dots, we didn't feel like anyone else was really doing this. I mean, there, of course, you know, Institute for Humane Education has been around for a long time. So there was that focus. They're very focused on education, and we were really looking for kind of another piece of that work. And so it really was this sense of, well, if we don't do it, who else is going to do it? And urgency basically is something that can really motivate people. But I would say, as advice to folks, you know, realize your limitations. We only have so much capacity, and, you know, we have to do what we're doing well if we want to have a peaceful and just world. So, you know, for what it's worth, I really can say, you know, I'm not exactly sure how I do it. I do know that I try to be really honest with myself about what I can handle and what I can't, and I would really encourage folks to do that. And, you know, working in partnership has been fabulous. I think that's a really key to what we're doing is, you know, this is about a movement. This is about partnerships. This is about facilitating the work, not doing it all ourselves. And I think if we can do that, we're going to create a whole network and a whole community that's really going to be effective.
maybe you can tell us a little bit. I know you can't speak for Stacia, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more about her and just acknowledge her role in the project.
Stacia and I really, I think what we found was we didn't know back in the day, as Connected Us was just about to get started, we didn't know each other, and we didn't know that this was something we were both kind of working towards and would eventually be put on the same path and put together and decide to start Connect the Dots. So Stacia also has a background in sexual violence response and prevention. She was a sexual assault nurse examiner. She did domestic violence exams as well. She's a public health person, and really just, you know, coming from the same perspective that I am, and, you know, really feeling like, wow, all the work that we're doing when we're doing this work against domestic and sexual violence is somewhat limited. And I think we both, you know, same experience as the woman who emailed me that she was crying when she found us, you know, same idea there. When we met each other, we were just completely thrilled. Mm-hmm. We had both felt so alone in the work, and, you know, it's really core to who we are is this connectionist lens, and that we want to do the most that we can with the time that we have. And we just felt like we were falling short and didn't know where to go from there. And so, you know, that really created this necessity for Connect the Dots.
Mm. It's so nice. You found an ally. And it seems like that relationship has been really great for both of you. That's so nice to see, because it, you know, it's not only about making connections and thinking about how, you know, power operates, but also making connections with each other in relationships, right? So I'm just delighted. We only have a couple minutes left. I'm wondering if you can point to the future for us in the short term, in the long term. What can we expect to see from Connect the Dots?
I think in the short term, what you're going to see from Connect the Dots is a lot more organizationally, some forming going on, if I can use that word. It's taken a long time. There's, you know, it's no secret. We started, you know, back in 2005 and just, you know, had our website go up on January 1st of this year.
It looks great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So, you know, as you're talking about how busy we are and everything, that's an example. You know, we just kind of persevered and kept going no matter what was going on in our lives with moves and jobs and children and things like that. So you're definitely gonna see more work. We're looking at what kind of structure that we can take as an organization. You know, we've been a project for a long time, and I think that to do the kind of long-term work that I'll tell you about shortly that we're looking at, we probably just by necessity and, you know, law are gonna need to work more in our organizational structure. So you're gonna see a lot of that. You'll continue to see lots more writing. As I said, you're gonna see your Connect the Dots essays come out this summer. And hopefully you'll see a first ever Connect the Dots conference coming out as well. So they're all going on behind the scenes. And then so long term, you can go to our website and see the projects that we're working on. I think one of the goals, because we really, really have a mission for capacity building and really facilitating this work, is mini grants. We want to be able to provide money, honestly, for folks to do this work, to build partnerships, to work across movements. And I actually have been a funder at the statewide level in Oregon. And so as much as, you know, we kind of reject, you know, capitalist notions and all of these things, I do really firmly believe that it does take resources, and oftentimes those are fiscal resources, to really be able to do the work that we're doing effectively, to build partnerships and things like that. So we're really hoping to develop mini grants. We have our first partnership for a fund that we're calling the Hurrah Fund, because it's Hurrah, which is a vegan lip balm company that has agreed to give us $1 every mint lip balm that they sell. And that's something you can find out more on the website as well. So we're hoping to build more funds so we can then contribute to capacity building in that way as well.
Very exciting. I'm really looking forward to potentially having you back on the show when the essays are published. That would be great.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Ashley Meyer. We will talk to you again soon. Stay tuned on Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We will be talking with Jason Letterman from Friends of the Sea Otter after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. Before the break, we were speaking with Ashley Meyer, co-founder and co-director of Connect the Dots. And now we're back with Jason Letterman, the program manager at Friends of the Sea Otter. Friends of the Sea Otter is an advocacy group in the United States that is dedicated to actively working with state and federal agencies to maintain, increase, and broaden the current protections for sea otters, a species currently protected by state and federal laws and on the endangered species list. Friends of the Sea Otter work to inspire the public at large about the otter's unique behavior and habitat and to protect sea otters from a wide range of threats. It's in large part due to Friends of the Sea Otter's efforts that California's southern sea otter population has grown. Welcome to Animal Voices, Jason Letterman.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. We're really excited to talk to you today about otters. We haven't ever done a show about otters, so they're the unsung sea heroes, I think.
Excellent, yes.
So for folks who have never heard of the No Otter Zone on California's southern coast, can you explain what it is and why it was initially implemented in 1986?
Absolutely, yeah. The initial program was implemented. It had two aspects to it. One was the translocation program, which would transport otters from the parent range in the central California coast to an island off the coast of Santa Barbara in Southern California called San Nicolas Island. And the idea behind this was that this population on San Nicolas Island, this translocated population, would be able to serve as a reserve in case an oil spill or some other natural hazard afflicted the parent range of the sea otters, of the California sea otters, because the California sea otter is so narrowly distributed along the California coast that it was believed any kind of oil spill would result in a complete extinction of that subspecies. And of course, we wouldn't want that. So the idea was to bring a colony to San Nicolas Island so that these otters could repopulate the parent range in case an oil spill wiped out the species. And, you know, this has historical precedence, and they've done this in actually British Columbia. They translocated some otters there, and now they have a healthy population, and also in Alaska. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but we'll get to that later. The other aspect of the program was to create this no otter zone, which would be basically along the whole coast of Southern California from Santa Barbara down to the border of Mexico. This was more of a result of a deal struck between conservationists and the shellfish fisheries down there. The shellfish people were afraid that if sea otters were translocated to San Nicolas Island, that they would expand from that island and eat all the shellfish and sort of destroy their fishery that they have going there. So the deal that was brokered was that the conservationists would get this translocated population at San Nicolas Island, and the shellfish people would get a no otter zone where if otters swim into this no otter zone, they would be picked up by the Fish and Wildlife Service and removed. Of course, this all hinged on whether or not the translocated population would be successful. And right from the bat, it proved to be a failure. They translocated about 140 animals to San Nicolas Island from Central California, and only 13 remain a couple years later. Most either swam back to their parent range through the no otter zone to Central California or died from the translocation process. So there were only about 13 sea otters at the island around 1992. And so since then, we've been sort of pushing for the Fish and Wildlife Service to end this program, leave the otters at San Nicolas Island that are there, but end this no otter zone because it was really causing a problem for relocating otters outside the zone.
As you're talking about the translocation program, I'm just trying to picture how it is that you relocate, how you uproot an entire population of otters and move them.
Yeah, I mean, there are divers who specialize in this kind of thing, who work with the California Department of Fish and Game. You go after otters with nets and you try and take care of them as much as possible. Some otters were sent to the Monterey Bay Aquarium first to go and undergo treatment and observation before they were sent to San Nicolas Island. And then you just, you know, they release them on San Nicolas Island and hope, because San Nicolas Island does have suitable otter habitat. It was thought that the island by this time would be supporting a population of 250 to 300 otters. And of course, it's not supporting anywhere near that number for, you know, reasons really unknown why sea otters Southern Sea Otters didn't want to stay at San Nicolas Island when they had been successful in other colonies in the northern part of the range.
Hmm. So the no otter zone doesn't necessarily serve the interests of the otters.
Oh, absolutely not. No. I mean, it was a deal that was made to try and get a reserve population. I mean, it was made with good intentions on the side of the conservationists because they were afraid an oil spill would actually exterminate the species altogether. And I mean, just a couple of years later, after the translocation program was started, you had that Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska, which killed thousands of sea otters. It killed more as many sea otters in Alaska than the whole population of southern sea otters in California. You know, so it is a real threat, mostly because sea otters are really susceptible to an oil spill. Unlike other marine mammals, sea otters don't rely on blubber or fat for warmth, and they rely almost entirely on their fur, the densest fur in the kingdom. And when oil comes into contact with the fur, it has a matting effect that completely robs it of any kind of heat-trapping abilities. And so the otter usually either freezes to death, or they, when they're grooming themselves, they ingest the oil and die that way.
Horrifying.
So it was, yeah, I mean, it was a major threat. I mean, it was one of the reasons why the species was listed on the endangered species list, is because they were so susceptible to an oil spill in California. So the no otter zone was sort of a deal that was brokered in order to get this reserve population established at San Nicolas Island. But it's later been proven through many different studies that it's actually causing more harm to the species than good. To actually pick up and remove otters that swim into the no otter zone is extremely damaging to the species, considering that their major region of growth is in Southern California, right on the border of the no otter zone. So you're continually seeing all these otters swimming into the no otter zone, you know, conveniently ignoring the man-made artificial boundary that stretches from Point Conception into the ocean. You know, I don't know why, but sea otters for some reason aren't obeying the law, and they're swimming into the no otter zone, and removing the otters is causing a lot of harm to the species.
In a press release that you recently wrote for Friends of the Sea Otter program, you announced that there is an opposing bill that would actually stop the Fish and Wildlife Service from planning to end the no otter zone. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so almost from the onset of, the program was a failure, from 13 otters remaining at San Nicolas Island after 140 were translocated there. So, and the population has been growing slowly up and through to the 2000s. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service has been trying to end the program. Within the actual bill that created the no otter zone, there are failure criteria that if the program meets these criteria, then the program should be canceled. And one of the criteria is the population at San Nicolas Island not reproducing or not at a sustainable level of animals. And that has been the case for decades. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service has been trying to end the program administratively, but they've come into lots of opposition from the shellfish fisheries down there, who are afraid of otters expanding into their fishing grounds and depleting the shellfish there, which is the shellfish there are only there because sea otters aren't there as a result of the fur trade, where sea otters were completely wiped out, and so the shellfish population artificially became inflated. So the Fish and Wildlife Service has been in the process to end this program, and it's been decades, the decades long process, which should have been only a couple years. Last August, they finally released a final environmental review, opened it for public comment, proposed to end the no otter zone and leave the animals at San Nicolas Island, who are already there, leave them there without removing them. And the public comment period ended in November, and so the Fish and Wildlife Service has a year to finish the determination and finally end the no otter zone. And the shellfish fishing people must have gotten scared that the no otter zone would be removed, and so they've contacted their own lobbyists and helped form this bill that would, if passed by Congress, would delay that decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service yet again, and keep the no otter zone in place until a plan is made that would ensure current harvest levels of shellfish are maintained in the future, which of course is almost impossible to do, considering that the fishery has been in decline for years as well. So, and that's not due to sea otters or anything like that. It's just due to unsustainable fishing practices.
So as far as otters themselves go, I mean, we're here in Ontario, Canada, and we don't have sea otters here. We have the Great Lakes, freshwater. Yeah, hard to believe, right? So most of us around here have had very limited experiences with sea otters. Yeah. So can you tell us more about them? How do they live? What are their social lives like? And what sorts of natural behaviors are frustrated by the no otter zone?
Yeah, so sea otters, I've already told you that they're unique among the marine mammals in that they rely on their fur for warmth. They're unique in that they use tools to eat their prey. In order to crack the shells open of various shellfish, they actually dive to the ocean floor and bring back up rocks, and then they lay on their back and sort of crack the shell open with rocks on their bellies and eat the shellfish that way, which is actually really, it sounds strange, but it's actually sort of has a tranquil effect when you're out in the ocean. Like, I like to go sea kayaking, and when you're out in the ocean and you hear nothing but waves, and then you hear the tap, tap, tap of a sea otter trying to break open a shell, it's actually really nice. It's, you know, one of the reasons why I'm in this work.
That sounds incredible. And as you're describing them coming up with rocks and cracking open dinner, I'm reminded of the pictures that are on the Friends of Sea Otter website. There's a series of Flickr pictures that people can check out. And there's some really incredible images of sea otters being sea otters and images of them eating and floating around in a sea of kelp. It's great.
Exactly. You know, as an advocacy organization, we're really fortunate to be working for sea otters because they are extremely adorable. Most people, you know, just, you go, oh, when they see pictures of them or when they see them in the wild. So it makes that part of our mission a little bit easier, that people immediately connect and enjoy sea otters in that way.
Yeah. So other than them being cute and eating various shellfish and using tools, which is really actually very interesting because sea otters aren't an animal that I associated with tool use. Other than that, what can you tell us about how sea otters live?
They're mostly solitary marine mammals. Males do have territories that they guard and that they hunt in. And females, not so much. They can travel in and out of male territories. But a unique feature is that because they rely on fur and a high metabolic rate for their warmth, they have to eat almost 20 to 25% of their body weight each day, which is a lot of shellfish. And you can imagine the pressure that puts on the ecosystem as well. To have, you know, hundreds of sea otters eating 20-25% of their body weight each day is a lot of pressure on shellfish populations. And so there is a need for sea otters to expand their territory, which is one of the problems that we're learning about in Southern California, because sea otters are growing mostly, the population is growing tremendously in the southern part of their range, so around Santa Barbara, and yet they're legally speaking not supposed to be in this no otter zone, you know, but they need to keep expanding in order to have enough food to eat, because we scientists believe that they're reaching the carrying capacity in the environment here in Monterey and off the coast of Big Sur, possibly.
So what you're saying is they're spreading out to find better sources of food?
Exactly. So the males need to swim somewhere to establish their own territory, large enough that can support them and whoever else is their neighbors. So they need to spread from current sea otter habitat, because they're just, you know, the food limitations is causing a lot of stress on the animal. Having to hunt 50 to 60% of their time is spent hunting, and that has possible side effects on their energy use and whatnot, and makes them more susceptible to diseases and pollution and possibly, even now that we're learning, there's been an increase in shark attacks as well. So it could be that sea otters are not having the energy to evade predators and whatnot.
Yeah, it sounds like it's taking a toll on their mental and emotional well-being, even.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can look at, there's a wetland near Monterey where I live called Elkhorn Slough, and this place is one of the last remaining wetlands in California, and it's just packed full of sea otter food. And this actually has the most... It's the densest sea otter population, southern sea otter population in all the world. And you see them here who they can really just reach down their paw and pick up a shellfish and eat it. You know, it's so easy to find prey there. And so you see sea otters having a lot more leisure time, a lot more pups are being born there. And, you know, you see them acting what we think that they would have been acting like before all these other pressures, like pollution, disease, have been affecting them. And this is actually where the Monterey Bay Aquarium releases a lot of their rehabilitated otters, just because it's such a pristine, nice habitat for sea otters.
Just to come back to the point about the pressure put on the shellfish population by sea otters, when they're doing well, they're eating a lot. But this, again, is coming into conflict with fishermen. So, I mean, how do you approach that conflict of interest, you know? How does Friends of Sea Otters defend sea otters when they are coming into direct conflict with the interests of humans, which, as we all know, unfortunately, always get put at the top of the priority?
Right, exactly. We sort of urge a more long-term and broader view when thinking about sea otters and whether they should expand their range. Sure, they're probably going to eat shellfish, and that might have an impact on fishermen in Southern California on their livelihood. But, I mean, that's a small segment. And, I mean, that happened in Monterey as well, in Central California, when the sea otters were initially expanding their range. Shellfish fisheries were in existence up here. And what happened was the fishermen just adapted and started fishing for other things, because the beauty of the sea otter is that they're a keystone species in that they play a major role in shaping the coastal ecosystem. For instance, kelp forests, which are the foundation for many marine ecosystems here in California, and are, in fact, in some studies, in some cases, they're found more diverse than tropical rainforests. So these kelp forests are these really extremely productive and biodiverse ecosystems that support regional fish populations and serve as vital habitat for other fish and bottom-dwelling species, and their source of nourishment for many species. And sea otters are actually found to be essential to keeping these coastal kelp forests healthy. And they do that by eating the sea urchins. And sea urchins, of course, are natural kelp eaters. But when otter populations decline for whatever reason, urchin populations are left unchecked. And without any natural predators, urchins can become so numerous that they overgraze kelp forests. And we see this time and time again in Southern California and Alaska. The sea urchins destroy this extremely productive and important ecosystem. But when otters are there, they sort of they play a regulatory role in that they cull the sea urchin population, much like wolves cull elk or deer population on land. And that allows the ecosystem to rebound and support habitats for other fish, which are commercially viable as well. So you may have a decline in shellfish back to their natural distribution before sea otters were removed from the ecosystem, but you have a rebounding of other commercially viable fish. Of course, sea otters also play an economic role in that they're attractive. You know, lots of tourists like to see sea otters. I mean, if you walk anywhere around Monterey, especially the tourist parts, you see sea otters, their faces are on everything. They serve as commercial mascots. They serve as icons for people to go out and participate in marine recreation, boat rides, kayaking rental places. They support long-term economic development in these coastal communities. It can be seen as more important than the short-term profits of a few fishermen in Southern California. I mean, they're really supporting community-wide economic development.
I'm so glad you're able to talk about that, because it's important to think of ways that we can live together, I think.
And, exactly.
Yeah, and you've just demonstrated many ways that the humans and otters can actually coexist without having to implement some sort of no otter zone or to disrupt their natural behaviors or to put them under stress for no reason.
Exactly. It's been proven study after study that it's mutually beneficial to have sea otters off our coasts. And they may be eating shellfish that we won't be eating, but, you know, they provide so many other benefits for us, to the society as a whole, you know, other than just a small segment of fishermen, you know, of the population.
So how can people help end this no otter zone?
Right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the public comment period is over. We had a campaign, a grassroots campaign last fall to really support this decision to end the no otter zone. But right now, with this new congressional bill that's been out, H.R. 4043, it really does represent a serious threat to the sea otters, especially in Southern California, but really to Southern sea otters in general, because if the sea otter isn't allowed to naturally expand its range, then you're going to have them susceptible to oil spills and other things that can afflict such a narrow range. So we're really trying to mobilize the public to oppose this bill that could really harm the species in the long run. So people can go to our website and find a link to send a letter to their congressman or to sign a petition to to tell Congress really to quit stalling and finally end this no-order zone, which they've been working on for the past 20 years to end. You know, it's time. It's time to finally end it and let sea otters roam free.
Hmm. I read in your press release that there's also a so-called ecosystem management plan included in the proposed bill 4043. So can you tell us about that so-called ecosystem management plan and what kind of effect that would have for sea otters?
Yeah, I mean, this is the plan that the bill would mandate needs to be in place before the no-otter zone could be ended or changed for whatever reason. And really, this ecosystem management plan is just a handout to the shellfish fisheries, because in it requires that the current harvest of shellfish right now needs to be sustained in perpetuity. So any decision on the no-otter zone or any plan for future sea otter recovery has to maintain this current shellfish harvest rate in Southern California, which is, you know, like I said, almost impossible, mostly because it's already an unsustainable fishery and the shellfish stocks have been declining anyways. So that's what this ecosystem management plan would require, maintaining shellfish harvest rates, which doesn't really make sense, because if it's an ecosystem management plan, what does maintaining commercial fisheries have to do about it? And, you know, they also, the shellfish people have been using the endangered species of abalone here in California as sort of a red herring to try and stall sea otter recovery, because they contend that sea otters have decimated the abalone population, and then abalones are now listed as endangered on endangered species list, and that an expanding sea otter range would completely annihilate the species, which is just, you know, almost complete baloney, because abalone populations have been declining in the last 10 years where sea otters aren't present. They're not even there yet, and the abalone's population has been declining, mostly from disease, but also from over-harvesting. I mean, just in the recovery plans for these abalone that the Fish and Wildlife Service has to implement, scientists say that these stocks of abalone have declined and sea otters haven't even been in the region. And it's been mostly due to over-harvesting and disease. So the ecosystem management plan would also mandate that abalone populations be maintained as well. When the fact is that right now we have an unnaturally overabundance of sea urchins and other shellfish, mostly as a result because sea otters aren't there. When sea otters are present, they go back to their natural balanced state. You know, the sea urchins won't be commercially as broad-based as they are now. And it's just a question of whether or not we want the ecosystem in balance again. And, you know, that produces benefits for everybody. So the ecosystem management plan is really just another way for the commercial shellfish people to stall the no-otter zone and to maintain their current harvests of shellfish, mostly at the detriment to all the other benefits that I described that communities realize when the sea otters expand their range.
We're just getting down to the last few minutes of the show. Jason, can you tell us a little bit more about Friends of the Sea Otters programs? I know you do a lot of education, research, and advocacy for the protection of the sea otter. Can you tell folks a little bit more about Friends of Sea Otters?
We're a 40-year-old nonprofit here in Monterey, California, and while we do work on the national side of issues, advocating for sea otter-friendly policies and protecting sea otters from detrimental policies, we also run a robust local grassroots organization as well. We partner a lot with local organizations to offer volunteer positions in either otter spotting, which is up-and-coming program, or working with the Elkhorn Slough, which I mentioned earlier, in installing a sea otter exhibit in their visitor center. And, you know, we have volunteers who go into classrooms and educate. I mean, our main purpose is really to serve as educators, to educate the public and decision makers about sea otters. And so we work a lot with classrooms. We have volunteers who go into classrooms to talk to children, and we try and participate as much in the community as possible to teach people about sea otters and the threats that they face and the benefits that they bring to communities.
Great. And what's your website?
Our website is seaotters.org. And from there, you can see our programs by clicking on the programs link. And you can find our current action alerts by clicking on the take action link.
Excellent. Jason Luderman, Program Manager of Friends of the Sea Otter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine. Glad to be here.
That's all the time we have today on Animal Voices. As always, if you want to contact the Animal Voices team with comments, questions, or suggestions for show ideas, please email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Check out our website, animalvoices.ca, to access podcasts of this show, along with over 300 others. Thank you to our audio technicians, Neil Harvey and Aaron O'Sullivan, and thank you to Daniel Angrenon for his work producing today's show. Animal Voices is produced in St. Catharines at CFBU 103.7 FM and And of course, since 1996, Animal Voices has been broadcasting from CIUT 89.5 FM, University of Toronto's community radio station. You can also listen to Animal Voices on iTunes Radio under the College University category, Star Choice Channel 826, or Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946. I'm Catherine Brigantino. Thanks for listening.